asked Lester Holt of NBC. "This is not a third Obama term," Biden replied. "We face a totally different world than we faced in the Obama-Biden administration. President Trump has changed the landscape."
Have you heard of the Bilderberg Group? Probably not. Well, that's understandable because members of the group work really hard to remain anonymous. The Bilderberg Group consists of between 120 to 150 powerful people who meet for 3 days once a year to discuss foreign policy. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Now, since 1954, the Bilderberg Group has been gathering in secret to discuss everything from the rise and fall of communism to nuclear warfare to cybersecurity. The group began as a way to create more cooperation between Europe and North America during the Cold War. Bilderberg releases an annual list of people who will attend and topics they will discuss, but beyond that, little leaves the walls of the meeting rooms. We disclose the truth behind the group's agenda.
We are endowed by our Creator with rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which nobody, no person, no group, no political party, not even our government, can take away from us.
Hitler had a dream that his big business should dominate the world. He called his dream the New Order.
We've already amended the Constitution dozens of times. Let's throw it away for a master plan run by a master state.
Morgan is the largest group. Then there is the strong Kuhn Loeb group, the Mellon interests, which have Westinghouse, DuPont with General Motors, and then there is Rockefeller and three other groups, making up a grand total of some $82 billion assets in 1945. Eight groups control the American economy, not only because of their concentration of wealth, but through their strategic ownership of basic industries. In spite of war, these companies operate internationally through subsidiaries, stock participation, and cartel agreements with various other companies.
Have you ever heard of the Bilderberg Group?
No.
No, never.
No, I haven't.
No, I haven't heard of that.
I don't know too much about that Bilderberg thing.
Have you guys ever heard about a group called the Bilderberg Group?
No.
Yeah, for the most part.
I have not.
Sounds kind of familiar, but I couldn't tell you what it was.
No, never heard of them.
Have you ever heard of a group called the Bilderberg Group?
No, I haven't.
The Bilderberg?
Well, what would you say if I told you it's a group of about 120 people on average who meet once a year? These are politicians, heads of media, military men, heads of finance. They meet once a year in secret. Behind closed doors, discussing foreign policy. What would you think?
What would I think?
Yeah. Do you think that's a good thing, a bad thing? Do you agree with it, disagree? Is there anything wrong with some of the most powerful and influential people in the world meeting behind closed doors and discussing things in secret?
It's a smart thing to get as many brains in a room as you can to discuss things. And if you're going to have open and honest dialogue, sometimes that information should be kept within the room. If they're going to make good and careful decisions on political initiatives, they need to be able to meet with the brightest minds in the country, and I don't think necessarily that we need to be inside that meeting.
I just tend not to recognize their power and just to, like, pretend they don't exist, because for all intents and purposes, they don't in my world. Like, no matter how much harm they do or how much good they think they do, I really couldn't care less.
In the spring of 1954, Joseph Redinger, a Polish political advisor and founder of the European movement that would lead to the founding of the European Union, started the Bilderberg Group, an informal and off-the-record conference for political and business elites from European and Western nations. With the help of Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, along with other powerful politicians and businessmen, they organized the first annual Bilderberg meeting at the Hotel de Bilderberg in Oosterbeek, Netherlands. The Prince, a former executive for IG Farben and a former Nazi SS party member before the war, was also an influential executive in the oil industry, working for Royal Dutch Petroleum. As a member of the Dutch royal family and the father of the current matriarch and fellow Bilderberger Queen Beatrix, Bernhard was a very powerful and influential member of the European community. The original stated goals of the Bilderberg Group were to bring together the leaders of business, finance, and politicians from Europe and Western nations in a forum that would allow for candid and frank discussions of international issues without the fear of being quoted or recorded. Thus, the meetings are held in secret and are by invitation only. For almost 60 years, the Bilderberg Group has been meeting behind closed doors in luxury hotels around the world to discuss in secret their plan for global control of world events and markets. Over the years, their members have included heads of state, politicians, business executives, media moguls, global financiers, military leaders, intelligence agencies, and many other powerful organizations and individuals whose reach extends to every corner of the world. Some notable members have included the Rothschild banking family, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, Prince Philip and Prince Charles of the British royal family, international financier David Rockefeller, and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. The members of the Bilderberg Group have such an influence over the media that until recent years, their name and existence has been quietly kept from the general public through a veritable media blackout. With the advent of new social media tools and advances in technology, the independent media has been exposing these annual meetings on an increasing scale. We have reached the turning point. The Bilderberg Group is now finding it almost impossible to stay out of the spotlight and hide their powerful cabal from the public.
In the 21st century, we still have monarchies who have influence and wealth. Then how come bills can't get signed without the Queen of England's approval? How come the Canadian Parliament can be suspended by the Queen of England if she wishes? If she has no power, why does the final decision-making process rest with her?
We could talk about the 99%, but it's really the 99.99999%, because the people that are in here, they're not one out of 100, they're not one out of 1,000, they're not one out of 10,000, 100,000, they're more like one out of a million or 10 million, or beyond that, okay?
The billionaire club.
That's right. It's the billionaire and trillionaire club, and you and I, we're not in it, we're not ever going to be in it, so we got to hold their feet to the fire. We've got to expose what's going on here. We've got to find out who the 2012 attendees are, and we've got to keep our eyes on the headlines in the next coming weeks, months, and even years to see what these associations have done geopolitically, because they'll be in the headlines. When you have someone like Davignon claiming, and not really claiming because he's on the inside, he would know better than you and I, that the Bilderberg Group was instrumental in creating the European Union and the Euro. I would say that's a pretty big deal. And whether that's evil or not, that's a geopolitical
political move, and that decision was made by this group.
What you need to do is look up who are the companies they work for, who else have they worked for, what are their agendas, what are they in the news doing that will tell you so much about the reach of Bilderberg, about why they invite these people, and about how they put the world together. In the case of Europe, you heard that, quote, Goldman Sachs rules the world, where you've got Peter Sutherland, head of Goldman Sachs International Board of Directors out of Ireland. He's telling them to accept the austerity and the other financial plans.
Throughout history, we've had people with power attempting to consolidate their power and hold on to it. So that's really the agenda here. The agenda is to stay as powerful as possible for as long as possible and crush any competition.
In recent years, the lack of coverage from the mainstream media on the Bilderberg Group has been a problem as far as raising awareness about these conferences. However, 2012 is a major turning point for the Bilderberg Group, as the independent media have been here providing the coverage that's been lacking from the mainstream.
Where's Fox News been for the last 15 years? CNN for the last 20 years? Why does Sean Hannity ridicule anybody that calls in and asks about the significance of the Bilderberg Group? Obviously, they're on the payroll. When people say that, quote, they control the media, they're talking about the secret establishment.
I'm just here to cover the Bilderberg Conference and try to do what the mainstream media is lacking. It's not fair to say that there's no coverage of Bilderberg, because even some of the Bilderberg-owned outlets in the mainstream media have covered it, but it's been so far and few between that I think it's important for us as people, as citizens, and as journalists, as professionals, to come down here ourselves and investigate it.
I'm definitely down here just to protest the real 1% that's meeting here at the Westfields Marriott behind closed doors. We're not seeing any major media out here.
Where's CNN? Where's the mainstream media? Where's Fox, MSNBC? Any of these stations, they are not here.
The mainstream media is owned by these people. There's only a handful of what you call mainstream media covering this, because this isn't supposed to exist. Our media, until just about 5 years ago, said that Bilderberg did not even exist.
It's been definitely incredible seeing so many people come all over the world just to participate in bringing awareness to the Bilderberg Group. It's by far the largest Bilderberg protest that I have ever seen. A lot of alternative media, a lot of attention being brought to the Bilderbergers. The mainstream media is failing, but the alternative people's media is becoming the mainstream media, and we're proving that by covering Bilderberg.
We want to make sure that we can get documentation of the attendees just to have confirmation of who is in attendance. Once you know, you can absolutely confirm who is in attendance. You can have a better feel for what are some of the things that are going to be discussed.
The Bilderberg Group was founded by Nazis after World War II with their European cohorts in the United States to try to bring in a one world government. These people are terrorists, 110%. The government has been usurped and completely hijacked. The United States flag is not hanging upside down in distress. The flag was taken a long time ago.
They've known about it since the very beginning, because their founders, Katherine Graham, and now her son, Donald Graham, come every single year without fail.
They're not talking about it. We have to. We will. And people are paying attention to that. And they're starting to trust us. And every day we're getting bigger and bigger.
The media moguls here that do participate at the Bilderberg meeting are failing. They're not successful at all in any way, shape, or form. Their businesses, their whole enterprises are failing. And what you see is people rising up.
End the fear! End the fear! End the fear! End the fear!
There has to be at least 500 people here now, and the veteran who was arrested yesterday was just arrested again. There's large people gathering in front of where the Bilderberg members inside the building can actually hear the people outside, and that's where a group of police officers grabbed this guy, same guy from yesterday, and it appears that they are making an example and trying to keep everybody away from the area where the people inside can definitely hear everything that is going on.
We're bullhorning in Bilderberg. They send cops down to stand behind us. We turn, and they just arrest somebody for no reason to get us to chase them down the street. They grab him, take him away like prey, and we run out and follow after.
The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching!
This group is meeting with government officials. It violates federal law, the Logan Act. And For decades, they said it didn't even exist. This is the real oligarchs that run our government, run Europe, run most of the world, to the big central banks, and the fraud that they engage in. These are the real tyrants. So we're identifying them, not the puppet presidents and prime ministers. We're going directly to the financial oligarch, the robber barons.
In 2008, it was revealed that the Canadian government, under the leadership of Bilderberg member Stephen Harper, would be buying $25 billion worth of mortgage pools through the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. Shortly after the election in October of 2008, the re-elected Harper Conservatives unilaterally announced the government will purchase up to an additional $50 billion of insured mortgage pools by the end of the fiscal year as a part of its ongoing efforts to maintain the availability of longer-term credit in Canada. This action will increase to $75 billion, the maximum value of securities purchased through Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. There was no debate in the Canadian Parliament over whether to hand out $75 billion in taxpayer money to the private chartered banks, nor was it covered by the Bilderberg-controlled mainstream media. The control of the Bilderberg Group extends not only to the media and the control of information, but also to the Canadian banking system itself and our ability to control our own currency. In 1938, Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King nationalized the Bank of Canada, giving control of the Canadian currency to the people of Canada. Although the issuance of currency is held solely by the Bank of Canada, the creation of credit through the issuance of loans is still largely controlled by private chartered banks. As part of the Bank of Canada's charter, the government can borrow up to 50% of its own money from the Bank of Canada at 0% interest. The other half of the interest is paid back into the government, allowing for the financing of our own infrastructure, such as the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Trans-Canada Highway. Because of Bilderberg member Paul Martin, Canada now borrows its money from the private chartered banks at the going interest rate, effectively handing over the usury and interest to private corporations. Prior to Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, all banks had to hold an 8% reserve, meaning they could lend out the same money 12.5 times through credit and loans. Mulroney dropped this to a 0% reserve, allowing private banks to loan as much money as they want, simply by entering a new line on a ledger. Currently, the Bank of Canada is only responsible for 5% of the actual debt created in the form of currency. The private chartered banks, such as Royal Bank of Canada and TD Bank, own the remaining 95% of all debt. Think of how much control this amounts to when you consider all of the digital payment and loan options used today, such as credit cards, debit cards, internet payments, RFID chips, smartphone purchases, and even biometric identification, which is now used in India for bank withdrawals. Very few people use real currency, and the trend is turning to an increasing reliance on digital and computer technologies, of which are largely controlled by members of the Bilderberg Group. Members of the Bilderberg Group who are involved in the Canadian banking system include President and CEO of Royal Bank of Canada, Gordon Nixon; President and CEO of TD Bank Financial Group, Edmund Clark; Deputy Chair of TD Bank Financial Group and former Canadian Ambassador to the United States, Frank McKenna; former Minister of Finance and Director of Manulife Financial, Michael Wilson; Managing Director of Credit Suisse Securities, Ronald S. Lloyd; former CEO of Scotiabank, Peter C. Godsoe; former Governor of the Bank of Canada, David A. Dodge; and Governor of the Bank of Canada and former Goldman Sachs executive, Mark Carney.
501c3 tax-exempt foundations have to make certain forms publicly available. And so somebody tipped me off about this, that the 990 forms are available for the Bilderberg Group. And I got the years 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010. Well, first of all, they're operating under the 501c3 tax-exempt name American Friends of Bilderberg. The 2008 forms also show a list of very interesting donors. Henry Kissinger, $20,000. David Rockefeller, $50,000. Freeport McMoRan Foundation, $10,000. Microsoft, $75,000. Peter Thiel from PayPal, $75,000. Goldman Sachs, $25,000. The Washington Post, $25,000. So, of course, the Washington Post is going to be reluctant to report on them when they are literally funding them, and I have the proof in my hand.
Other large donors of the Bilderberg Group include $25,000 from Lazard, a large investment bank which is based in New York's Rockefeller Center. Lazard is one of the key players in the Bilderberg finances, attending dozens of meetings over the years. Another large donor and regular attendee to Bilderberg is co-founder of Kohlberg Kravis Roberts & Company, Henry Kravis. KKR is a private equity firm with over $62 billion in assets as of 2011. Kravis donated $50,000 in 2008 to the Bilderberg Group. Billionaire financier David Rockefeller of Eaton Bank has been a steady donor to the Bilderberg meetings and has been a cornerstone of the group's development, attending nearly every conference since its inception in 1954. Rockefeller is an honorary lifetime chairman of the Bilderberg Group and has been involved in the development of many other powerful globalist think tanks, such as the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations. In 1965, David Rockefeller gave a speech to the International Industrial Conference in San Francisco, where he said, "We have entered upon an era in which interdisciplinary cooperation on a worldwide basis must be the cornerstone of accomplishment. Each of us has the duty to fashion his own contribution to fit the grand design of a global community. For many of us, the marketplace of tomorrow will be no less than this whole planet of Earth. What we do will manifest itself in ways that we cannot foretell, and it will have an unforeseen impact upon individual lives and whole societies. What we are is God's gift to man. What we become is man's gift to God."
The Rockefeller-Rothschild merger obviously had some things in the works before then, but for those that don't know, the Rothschilds have bought up 37% of the main financial institute of the Rockefellers. They're going to be talking about swallowing up smaller financial institutions, like they say in the article. Essentially, they see opportunity in crisis, and we've known some smaller banks, a lot of smaller banks, have gone down in the last 2 or 3 years. Well, now they're consolidating power. They're going to buy up those smaller banks, and don't be surprised if you see them bail out or take a large stake in some of the bigger banks that have been having problems, such as maybe even Bank of America and JP Morgan.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In
in the limelight.
The article you're about to hear under the heading Good Signs India and Brazil to be Buddies with China Again has been authored by Ken Merck, who has taught economic theory and public policy at university level for 33 years. Stay with us to learn more about his views. The BRICS summit hosted by Russia very recently appeared to be on the right track for boosting cooperation among the world's largest emerging economies. Each of the leaders of the five countries, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, seemed to express a strong desire to work together on tracking such fields as the economy, the COVID-19 pandemic, terrorism, and other issues of mutual concern, as reflected in the Moscow Declaration, the official document listing the leaders' pledges. All five leaders, for example, vowed to collaborate on developing and producing a COVID vaccine. So what should the world take out of such an approach at the BRICS summit? The world should rejoice because such a meeting of minds would be good not only for the BRICS states themselves, but for the world at large, economically and geopolitically. Increased inter-BRICS trade and investment would spur international trade, reversing the pandemic-induced world recession. Cooperation between India and China would strengthen global security in the Asia-Pacific region and beyond. One could suggest that BRICS is a marriage made in heaven, as its members could help one another realize their economic and geopolitical potential. The economies of China and other four members are highly complementary. Brazil's, Russia's, South Africa's, and to some extent India's resources fueled China's manufacturing prowess. In turn, Chinese technology and funding jump-started economic development in Russia, Brazil, and South Africa. Chinese investment in India's technology upstarts and low-priced exports played no small role in enhancing the latter's economic growth. Indeed, it was China's buying of and investing in the resource and other industrial sectors that made BRICS what it is today, surpassing the group of seven countries in economic size. According to International Monetary Fund, the combined gross domestic product of the BRICS states in 2018 was $46.1 trillion, whereas that of G7 was $41.1 trillion in purchasing power parity terms. Since the G7 economies are already developed, there is little room for expansion. The five BRICS countries, including China, on the other hand, still have considerable room for economic growth. China's private consumption as a percentage of GDP was only 40% in 2018, as compared with the G7's 70%. Designating consumption as the engine of growth in China's 14th five-year plan should result in high growth rates over the period because of the country's 1.4 billion population, between 400 million and 500 million of whom are classified as middle class. In addition, the government plans to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on infrastructure and housing construction, connecting new and existing cities. Massive domestic demand in China could offer the other BRICS states huge export opportunities, particularly after China's relations with Western resource-based economies such as Australia and Canada soured. Russia, Brazil, and South Africa could replace those two Western countries as China's major suppliers of oil, natural gas, iron ore, and other commodities over the next 5 years and beyond. Indeed, resetting their relationship with China would be in the best interest of India and Brazil because it will be the only economy that is expected to enjoy positive growth in 2020 and relatively high annual rates of around 5% over the next 5 years, thanks to the government's quick and effective measures in preventing the spread of the pandemic. That has allowed Beijing to reopen the economy sooner than any other major economy. The pandemic in the European Union, the UK and the US, in fact, is surging, forcing more lockdowns and exacerbating economic woes. US President Donald Trump refusing to concede this month's election and politicizing the pandemic in the US could spike infection cases, stifling or at least slowing economic recovery. As a result, China seems to be the only major economy that could help its four partners reverse their pandemic-induced recessions. In addition to being able to buy huge quantities of resources, China is able and willing to invest trillions of dollars in Russia, India, Brazil, and South Africa through the Belt and Road Initiative. Meanwhile, China, being one of the countries having three vaccines ready for use over the next few months, it would be in a great position to help India and Brazil.
Around the World with Reporters.
After a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qablan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that, God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad Resistance Group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike, demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November. Prominent figures who rushed to welcome al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are languishing in Israel's jails without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. The inmates say their hunger strike is a bet to have their voice heard and to force the Israeli regime to end this illegal policy. Reports say more than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Maher al-Akhras has achieved victory through his hunger strike and he's free today. Experts say his battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention a glimmer of hope, enabling them to go on with their actions and their fight for justice that aim to get back their rights in Israeli jails. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion U.S. dollars in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Guzel Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategy, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but redevelopment being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted. According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Sudan's former premier Sadr al-Mahdi dies from the novel coronavirus at the age of 84. Al-Mahdi was Sudan's last democratically elected prime minister, who was transferred to the United Arab Emirates for treatment but succumbed to the illness nonetheless. The government declared 3 days of national mourning for his passing. Al-Mahdi was born in 1935 in the city of Omdurman and grew up during the last 2 decades of British imperial rule on Sudan. He became the country's prime minister in 1966, but his term did not last long as he was ousted in 1967 by a coalition of defectors. Later in 1986, Al-Mahdi was elected again as premier, but was toppled once more in 1989 by former ruler Omar al-Bashir in a military coup. The post of prime minister of Sudan was then abolished. Since his ouster, al-Mahdi continued to lead the Umma Party, one of the largest opposition movements during Bashir's era, and spent a period in exile, but eventually returned to Sudan in the year 2000. He threw his weight behind the mass protest movement that eventually prompted the military to overthrow the president last year. After Bashir's ouster, al-Mahdi pushed for a transfer to civilian rule, warning of the risks of a counter-coup and calling for the powerful paramilitary rapid support forces to be integrated into the army. Al-Mahdi was also against the normalization of ties with Israel and supported the axis of resistance against the regime. In October, he slammed US President Donald Trump's announcement that Sudan would start normalizing ties with Israel. Al-Mahdi stressed that Trump's statement contradicts the Sudanese national law and contributes to the elimination of the peace process in the Middle East. He accused Trump of being racist against Muslims and described Israel as an apartheid regime. However, Sudan became the third Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in August. Al-Mahdi warned that normalizing ties with Tel Aviv will prepare the ground for the ignition of a new war.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see, never again, the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
This means that member states cease to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough.
The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Arrivals on the Canary Islands have surged. Almost 17,000 people have reached their shores so far this year, more than 10 times last year's total, and hundreds have died trying. The Spanish government has promised to set up camps and shelters for more than 7,000 people, but overwhelmed local authorities and activists say the migrants are being treated with contempt.
The majority of migrants who are arriving are returnable, or expellable, if we may say. They are not candidates that apply to our reception system. Our reception system is tailored for vulnerable people and people who have asked for international asylum.
Over in France, images of homeless migrants camped out on a Paris square being evacuated by police have caused outcry, forcing lawmakers to comment on the situation that seems far from under control.
Cette manifestation était-elle autorisée?
Was this event authorized? Was it legal? The answer is no. Should we have left on the Place de la République hundreds of tents, hundreds of people without evacuating them? The answer is no. Was I, like you or others, shocked to see some images on social media of evacuation? Proof that this is a free country? Of course.
Ceux qui n'ont rien, pas même à toi.
Those who have nothing, not even a roof over their heads, sheltered themselves symbolically under the statue symbolizing the Republic to call for fundamental rights. They were peaceful. The order was given for them to be evacuated at any cost, although they did not represent any threat at all.
Immigration to Europe is fueled by wars and economic instability in which Europe is complicit. The bloc's exploitation of resources and interventionism goes on around the globe, and countries like Britain sell arms to almost all regimes deemed violators of human rights. To stop migrants setting out in the first place, millions of euros are also pumped into countries like Libya, a conduit for African migrants, and end up in the hands of militiamen, traffickers and Coast Guard members who imprison and torture thousands of migrants. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The latest challenges in the Muslim world. This is the main theme of the gathering, attended by political activists.
On top of the conference's agenda was the French government's recent blasphemy to Prophet Muhammad, which triggered worldwide condemnation from Muslims and religious leaders.
Insulting the Prophet of Islam is tantamount to blasphemy against all other religions. The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. Religions don't have any issues with each other. As a Jewish scholar, I believe what the French president said against Islam is unacceptable. He has ignored the sentiments of around 2 billion people.
Delegates also condemned Sudan, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates for their normalization of ties with Israel. Last month, Sudan became the fifth Muslim country after Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, and Jordan to establish diplomatic ties with Israel. Delegates at the conference called it a strategic folly and a backstabbing of Palestinians who have been suffering under more than 7 decades of Israel's occupation.
Those treacherous regimes have never cared about the interests of Muslims. They only seek to consolidate their foothold as rulers. I'm sure that the people of Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan do not share the stance of their regimes toward Israel. Muslims will never recognize Israel and its occupation of Palestine.
Although the Arab-Israeli détente infuriated the Muslim world, activists say it should not come as a surprise and is solely a revelation of their long-standing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power balance.
Experts here find the root cause of regional crises in lack of coordination and a growing chasm between regional states. They say external players such as the U.S. never want this gap to be bridged, since such a division has long been a chance for them to serve their interests in the region. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an official visit to Afghanistan, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh is seeking to boost ties between Kabul and Tehran via expanding mutual cooperation, mainly in terms of peace and security.
Security of Afghanistan is our high priority. We think that the security of two nations, Iran and Afghanistan, are very much connected to each other. So we think that through collaboration, through cooperation, we have to be able to secure a stable situation in Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman comes as many here believe Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and that is why players like Iran are struggling to keep their role in the country's peace and security.
Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and all regional players have developed new plans in line with their own interests. For instance, Daesh is replacing the Taliban in Afghanistan. The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman to Kabul proves Iran's effort to expand its role in Afghanistan's security.
The visit of Iran's delegation comes as Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan visited Kabul last week.
The recent political trips of Afghanistan's eastern and western neighbors to Kabul are a proof of importance of the country to them. That is especially at a time when insecurity is on the rise and negotiations are underway between the Afghan government and the Taliban to bring a lasting peace to the war-torn nation. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 15,000 COVID-19 infections and over 65 deaths, mostly since late August. Since Thursday, around 3,000 infections were detected in the impoverished enclave. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 100 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants. 80% of ventilators for coronavirus patients have already been taken up. The World Health Organization cautioned that within a week, the health system in Gaza may become unable to care for critical cases.
The situation is becoming extremely dangerous in Gaza amid rapid increase of coronavirus infections, and people here will continue to suffer. The health sector is already fragile and in a very bad shape because of the Israeli blockade. The health system will soon be unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and other health needs.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's health system and almost paralyzed its ability to provide health services by refusing to allow in vital medical equipment amid the apathy of the international community. Unfortunately, some Arab regimes are normalizing ties with Israel and encouraging it to perpetrate more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Local authorities have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, especially on the health system. The health system is struggling with the logistics, lack of medical equipment, as well as testing kits for the virus and hospital ventilators to keep patients alive.
Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A debate on fundamental rights in the EU has just concluded in the European Parliament. COVID-19 lockdowns and reduced access to services due to the pandemic have apparently made the elderly more vulnerable, and other groups too.
Women, children in poverty, and people with disabilities.
The 27-nation bloc's asylum system was castigated during the debate.
We have migrants left to rot and fester in camps, while boats of pregnant women and children are pushed out to sea by state forces in Greece. We have migrants raped with the branches of trees by state forces in Croatia. We have Muslims hounded in France.
It's claimed the EU's attitude towards refugees is facilitating abuses both within the bloc and in neighbouring countries.
Greece, Turkey, Poland, Belarus, Spain, Morocco, Hungary, Serbia, and in some countries, Croatia, they even face torture, humiliation, and sexual abuse.
Governments in EU nations, such as Czech Republic and Hungary, are fueling Islamophobia by the way they are dealing with the refugee crisis, according to experts.
They've sought to interpret that crisis as a one of Muslim invasion. And government narratives, when they're deployed in that way, can be very strong.
Other fundamental rights abuses in the EU are also being highlighted. Spanish authorities are criticised for imprisoning activists in Catalonia.
We spend all our time asking Hungary and Poland to act like genuine democratic states, but we don't do anything on Spain. Without civil and political rights, the European project is done for.
Some lawmakers accuse the EU of hypocrisy in terms of how it tries to export its values.
Let's just take one example, cozying up to Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have appalling human rights records, while at the same time imposing really tough sanctions against countries such as Russia and Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab.
It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot of the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In order to roll back catastrophic carbon emissions, humans must start developing the technologies for large-scale removal of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, says a recent study. Furthermore, the study found that the accelerated melting of Arctic ice and carbon trapped in melting permafrost may increase the amount of water vapor, methane, and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Recent research predicts that global heating will cause the planet average temperature to increase by between 2.6 degrees Celsius and 3.9 degrees Celsius over the next few centuries. Scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, in 2017 forecast worldwide sea levels to rise by between 1 and 8.2 feet, depending on the location, by the end of this century. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading, "Humans may have passed the point of no return in climate crisis," says a study, but that doesn't mean all hope is lost. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. humanity may have passed the point of no return in the climate crisis even if everyone on the planet stopped emitting all greenhouse gases at this very moment, according to a study published recently. The study published in the peer-reviewed British publication Scientific Journals alarmingly asserts that the world is already past the point of no return for global warming and that the only way to hold catastrophic damage caused by greenhouse emissions is to extract enormous amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The crisis simply will not stop from cutting man-made greenhouse gases. Jorgen Randers, one of the study's two lead authors, told Future Human. Humanity, stressed Randers, should accelerate its effort to cut greenhouse gas emissions